an ego, whilst living in the causal body, already recognizes the divine consciousness in all. When he looks upon another ego, his consciousness leaps up, as it were, to recognize the divine in him. But, on the buddhic plane, it no longer leaps to greet him from without, for it is already enshrined in his heart. He is that consciousness, and it is his. There is no longer the you and the I, for both are one facets of something which transcends, and yet include them both. It is not only that we understand another man, but that we feel ourselves to be acting through him, and we appreciate his motives as our own motives, even though, as said in the preceding chapter, we may perfectly understand that another part of ourselves, possessing more knowledge, or a different viewpoint, might act quite differently. The sense of personal property in qualities and in ideas is entirely lost, because we see that these things are truly common to all, because they are part of the great reality which lies equally behind all. Hence personal pride in individual development becomes an utter impossibility, for we see now that personal development is but as the growth of one leaf, among the thousands of leaves on one tree, and that the important fact is not the size or shape of that particular leaf, but its relation to the tree as a whole, for it is only of the tree as a whole that we can really predicate permanent growth. We have ceased altogether to blame others for their differences from ourselves, instead we simply note them as other manifestations of our own activity, for now we see reasons which before were hidden from us. Even the evil man is seen to be part of ourselves, page 283, a weak part, so our desire is not to blame him, but to help him by pouring strength into that weak part of ourselves - so that the whole body of humanity may be vigorous and healthy. Page 187. Thus, when a man rises to the buddhic plane, he can gain the experience of others. Hence it is not necessary for every ego to go through every experience, as a separate individual. If he did not want to feel the suffering of another, he could withdraw. But he would choose to feel it, because he wants to help. He enfolds in his own consciousness one who is suffering, and although the sufferer would know nothing of such enfoldment, yet it will, to a certain extent, lessen his sufferings. On the buddhic plane there is a quite new faculty, having nothing in common with faculties on the lower planes. For a man recognizes objects by an entirely different method, in which external vibrations play no part. The object becomes part of himself, and he studies it from the inside instead of from the outside. With such a method of apprehension, it is clear that many familiar objects become entirely unrecognizable. Even astral sight enables one to see objects from all sides at once, as well as from above and below, adding to that the further complication that the whole inside of the body is laid out before us, as though every particle were separately placed upon a table, adding to that again the fact that, while we look at these particles, we are yet at the same time within each particle, and are looking through it. It is apparent that it becomes impossible to trace any resemblance to the object which we knew in the physical world. Whilst the intuition of the causal body recognizes the outer, the intuition of buddhi recognizes the inner. Intellectual intuition enables one to realize a thing outside oneself, with buddhic intuition, one sees a thing from inside. Thus if, when working in the causal body, we want to understand another person, in order to help him, we turn our consciousness upon his causal body, and, page 284, study its peculiarities. They are quite well marked, and plainly to be seen, but they are always seen from without. If, wanting the same knowledge, we raise our consciousness to the buddhic level, we find the consciousness of the other man as part of ourselves. We find a point of consciousness which represents him, we might call it a hole rather than a point. We can pour ourselves down that hole, and enter into his consciousness, at any lower level that we wish, and therefore can see everything precisely as he sees it, from inside him, instead of from outside. It will easily be understood how much that lends itself to perfect understanding and sympathy. Yet, as has been said, in all this strange advance, there is no sense of loss of individuality, even though there is an utter loss of sense of separateness. Whilst that may seem a paradox, yet it is true. The man remembers all that lies behind him. He is himself the same man who did this action, or that, in the far-off past. He is in no way changed, except that now he is much more than he was then, and feels that he includes within himself many other manifestations as well. If, here and now, 100 of us could simultaneously raise our consciousness into the Buddhic world, we should all be one consciousness, but to each man, that consciousness would seem to be his own, absolutely unchanged, except that now it included all others as well. Buddhic vision reveals a person, not as an enclosure, but as a star radiating out in all directions. The rays of that star pierce the consciousness of the observer, so that it is felt to be a part of himself, and yet, page 188, not perfectly so. All observers agree that it is impossible, except by a series of contradictions, to describe the Buddhic state of consciousness. The power of identification is gained, not only with regard to the consciousness of people, but with regard to everything else, on the Buddhic plane. Everything is learnt, as said, from the inside, instead of from the outside. That which we are examining has become a, page 285, part of ourselves. We examine it as a kind of symptom in ourselves. This characteristic obviously constitutes a fundamental difference. Before it can be attained, utter selflessness must be acquired, because so long as there is anything personal in the disciple's point of view, he cannot make any progress with the Buddhic consciousness, which depends on the suppression of the personality. H. P. Blavatsky states that, Buddhi is the faculty of cognizing, the channel through which divine knowledge reaches the ego, the discernment of good and evil, also divine conscience, and the spiritual soul, which is the vehicle of Ma, the secret doctrine, I.P. 2. It is often spoken of as the principle of spiritual discernment. In the yoga system, Triya, a lofty state of trance, is related to the Buddhi consciousness, just as Sushupti is related to the mental consciousness, Svapna to the astral, and Jagra to the physical. These terms, however, are used also with other significances, being relative rather than absolute, vidi the mental body, p. 146. In the six stages of mind, jivan in the mental body, p. 146, that of nirada, or self-controlled, corresponds to activity on the Buddhic plane. In the physical body, the yellow prana which enters the heart chakra or force center represents the principle of buddhi. Although at the Buddhic level, a man still has a definite body, yet his consciousness seems equally present in vast numbers of other bodies. The web of life, which is constructed of Buddhic matter, is extended so that it includes these other people, so that, instead of many small separate webs, there is one vast web, which enfolds them all in one common life. Many of these others may, of course, be entirely unconscious of this change, and to them their own private little part of the web will still seem as much separated as ever would do so if they knew anything about our web of life. So, from page 286, this standpoint, and at this level, it seems that all mankind are bound together by golden threads, and make one complex unit, no longer a man, but man in the abstract. On the Buddhic plane, in some manner which is naturally quite incomprehensible to the physical brain, past, present and future all exist simultaneously. Neither is a man, on this plane, any longer subject to limitations of space such as we know on the physical plane. Hence, in reading the Akashic records, vidi the mental body, p. 238, he no longer needs, as on the mental plane, to pass a series of events in review, page 189, because, as said, past, present and future are simultaneously present to him. With consciousness fully developed on the Buddhic plane, therefore, perfect prevision is possible, though, of course, the man may not, in fact, will not be able to bring the whole result fully through into his lower consciousness. Nevertheless, a great deal of clear foresight is obviously within his power, whenever he chooses to exercise it, and even when he is not exercising it, frequent flashes of foreknowledge come through into his ordinary life, so that he often has an instantaneous intuition as to how things will turn out, even before their inception. The extension of the Buddhic plane is so great, that what may be called the Buddhic bodies of the different planets of our chain meet one another, so that there is one Buddhic body for the whole chain. Hence it is possible for a man, in his Buddhic body, to pass from one of these planets to another. We may note here that an atom of Buddhic matter contains 49^3 or 117 × 649 bubbles in koilon. A man who can raise his consciousness to the atomic level of the Buddhic plane finds himself so absolutely in union with all other men that, if he wishes to find another man, he has only to put himself out along the line of that other person in order to find him. The following may be taken as an example of the working of Buddhic consciousness. All beauty, whether it be of form or color, whether it be in nature or, page 287, in the human frame, in high achievements of art or in the humblest household utensil, is but an expression of the one beauty, and therefore, in the lowliest thing that is beautiful, all beauty is implicitly contained, and so, through it, all beauty may be realized, and he who himself is beauty, may be reached. To understand this fully needs the Buddhic consciousness, but even at much lower levels the idea may be useful and fruitful. As a master has expressed it, "Do you not see that there is but one love, so there is but one beauty? Whatever is beautiful, on any plane, is so because, it is part of that beauty, and, if it is pushed back far enough, its connection will become manifest. All beauty is of God, as all love is of God, and through these his qualities the pure in heart may always reach him." The full development of the Buddhic vehicle, however, belongs to the stage of the Arhat, though those who are as yet far from that level can gain in various ways touches of the Buddhic consciousness. Buddhi in the human spirit is the pure and compassionate reason, which is the wisdom aspect, the Christ in man. In the normal course of evolution, the Buddhic consciousness will be gradually unfolded in the sixth sub-race of the fifth root race, and still more so in the sixth root race itself. Page 190, one may trace the coming of the sixth sub-race in the scattered people found in the fifth sub-race, in whom tenderness is the mark of power. It is a synthesizing spirit which characterizes the sixth sub-race. Its members are able to unite diversity of opinion and of character, to gather round them the most unlike elements, and blend them into a common whole, having the capacity to take into themselves diversities, and send them out again as unities, utilizing the most different capacities, finding each its place, and welding all together into a strong whole. Compassion is strongly marked. It is that quality which is at once affected by the presence of weakness, answering, page 288, to it with patience, with tenderness, and with protection. The sense of unity and compassion will be a strength and a power which will be used for service, the measure of strength being the measure of responsibility and of duty. Page 191, Chapter 33, The Ego and the Monad, page 289. In Chapter 3 we study the coming forth of the monads, and considered briefly the general nature of the monads. In the chapter on initiation, we dealt with the effects which initiation produces on the relation between the monad and the ego. It will now be fitting to consider such further information as is available regarding the relation between the ego and the monad, and also deal a little more fully with the nature of the monad himself, and his attitude towards his manifestations in the lower worlds. Turning first to the nature of the monad himself, we are confronted with the difficulty that no direct observation of the monad, on his own plane, is at present possible to our investigators. The plane on which the monad resides, the Nupadaka plane, is at present beyond the reach of our clairvoyant investigators, the highest which those investigators can actually know of man, from direct observation, being the manifestation of the monad as the triple spirit on the plane of Tma. Even at that stage he is incomprehensible, for his three aspects are quite distinct and apparently separate, and yet are all fundamentally one in the same. Whilst no one below the rank of the adept can see the monad, yet the Arhat can know of its existence, for, on the plane of Tma, the triple manifestation can be perceived, and the rays which make that triple manifestation are obviously converging as they rise to the highest point. It can therefore be seen that they must become one, though the actual unity is out of the sight. We have already referred, vidp. 124, to the, page 290, possibility of focusing the consciousness in the highest level of the causal body, looking up the line that joins the ego and the monad, and, through that vision, realizing the identity with the deity. Perhaps the least misleading manner in which we can imagine the true nature of the monad to ourselves is to think of him as part of God, a part, however, of that which cannot be divided. Although, unfortunately, this is a paradox to the finite intellect, yet it enshrines an eternal truth which is far beyond our comprehension. For each monad is literally a part of God, apparently temporarily separated from him, while he is enclosed in the veils of matter, though in truth never for one moment really separated. He can never be apart from God, for the very matter in which he veils himself is also a manifestation of the divine. Although matter seems to us evil, because it weighs us down, clogs our faculties, and holds us back upon the road, yet this is only because as yet we have not learned to control it, because we have not realized that it also is divine in its essence, because there is nothing but God. It is a mistake to think of the monad as something very far away. For the monad is very near to us, is our self, the very root of our being, the one and only reality. Hidden, unmanifest, wrapped in silence and darkness though he be, yet our consciousness is the limited manifestation of that self, the manifested God in our bodies, which are his garments. Page 192. The monad has been variously described as the eternal man, a fragment of the life of God, a son of God, made in his image, a spark in the divine fire, the hidden God as he was known to the Egyptians: he is the God within us, our personal God, our true self, a fragment of the eternal, the real and only permanent I in man. The monads have been described also as centers of force in the Logos. Instead of speaking of human monads, it might perhaps be more accurate to speak of the monad manifesting in the human kingdom, though such pedantic, page 291, accuracy might be still more puzzling. H. P. Blavatsky wrote, "The spiritual monad is one, universal, boundless, and impartite, whose rays, nevertheless, form what we, in our ignorance, call the individual monads of men." The Secret Doctrine, I, 200. And the Occult Catechism expresses it: "I sense one flame, O Grudeva, I see countless undetached sparks burning in it. Thou sayest well. And now look around and into thyself. That light which burns inside thee, dost thou feel it different in any wise from the light that shines in thy brother men? It is in no way different, though the prisoner is held in bondage by karma, and though its garments delude the ignorant into saying, 'Thy soul and my soul.'" The Secret Doctrine, I, 145. To take a physical plane analogy, we recognize that electricity is one all the world over, and though it may be active in this machine or in that, the owner of no machine can claim it as distinctively his electricity. So also is the monad one everywhere, though manifesting in different directions, through apparently separate and different human beings. But, in spite of having the same source, and the same fundamental nature, yet each monad possesses a very distinct individuality of his own, in his manifestation on the plane of Ma, as a triple light of blinding glory. Even at that stage, each monad possesses certain qualities which make him distinct from every other monad. The consciousness of the monad on his own plane is complete, he shares the divine knowledge in his own world. But, in the lower world, he is to all intents and purposes unconscious. He cannot in any way touch the lower planes of life, the matter the being of a character which is not amenable to his influences. He, who has been in union with all around him, would, if plunged into denser matter, find himself in uttermost isolation, as in empty space, unconscious of all impacts and contacts of matter. Page 292. Nevertheless, everything is in him, by virtue of the one life that he shares, but it has to be brought out. Hence we speak of awakening the latent consciousness into life. Literally everything is in the monad, all divine knowledge. But, to bring that out, so that on any plane of matter he may know, is the whole work, page 193, of evolution. Hence the rationale of his evolutionary journey, down and again upwards, is for the purpose of acquiring that consciousness, of subjugating matter completely as a vehicle, until on each plane he answers to the vibrations of similar matter outside, and is able to bring out moods of consciousness, which answer to those outside impressions, and thereby make it possible for him to be conscious of them. G.O.S. Arundale gives an interesting account of the appearance and evolution of the monads. Looking upon the world, he writes, he sees our Lord the Sun expressed in myriad suns. Each monad is a sun in miniature, the sun divine throwing off sparking suns, charged with all his attributes. The process of evolution begins, and these sparks burst into color, rainbows with sun hearts, or centers. Every atom of light is an atom of unconscious divinity, slowly but surely fulfilling the will of the sun that it shall become unfolded into self-conscious divinity. Every atom is a sun unconscious, and shall become a sun self-conscious. When manifestation begins, the monad is thrown downwards into matter, to propel forwards and force evolution. Vidi the Secret Doctrine. 2.115. It is the mainspring of all evolution, the impelling force at the root of all things. This accounts for that mysterious pressure, which so much puzzles orthodox science, as to why things move onwards, as to what is the force which makes evolution, as to what gives rise to all the variety we find in this world, and the ever-present tendency to variation. The monad knows from the first what is his object, page 293, in evolution, and he grasps the general trend of it. But, until that portion of him, which expresses itself in the ego, has reached a fairly high stage, he is scarcely conscious of the details down here, or at any rate he takes little interest in them. He seems at that stage not to know other monads, but rests in indescribable bliss, without any active consciousness of his surroundings. The purpose, then, of the descent of the monad into matter, is that through his descent he may obtain definiteness and accuracy in material detail. To this end, as we have seen in the earlier chapters of this book, an atom of each of the planes of Ma, Buddhi and Manas is attached to the monad. The distinction of these atoms gives a precision that did not exist in the consciousness of the monad on his own plane. But, it may be asked, if the monad is of the essence of divinity in the beginning, and returns to divinity at the end of his long pilgrimage, if the monad is all-wise and all-good, when he starts on his journey through matter, why is it necessary for him to go through all this evolution, including, as it does, much sorrow and suffering, simply to return to his source in the end? The question is based on a misconception of the facts. When that which we call the human monad came forth from the divine, it was not, in reality, a human monad, still less an all-wise and all-good monad. It, page 194, returns, eventually, in the form of thousands of millions of mighty adepts, each capable of himself, developing into a logos. As a man who cannot swim, flung into deep water, at first is helpless, yet eventually learns to swim and move freely in the water, so is the monad. At the end of his pilgrimage of immersion in matter, he will be free of the solar system, able to function in any part of it, to create at will, to move at pleasure. Every power that he unfolds through denser matter, he retains forever under all conditions. The implicit has become explicit, the potential the actual. It his own will to, page 294, live in all spheres, and not in one only, that draws him into manifestation. For there was no developed individualization in the monad at first, it was simply a mass of monadic essence. The difference between its condition when issuing forth, and when returning, is exactly like that between a great mass of shining nebulous matter, and the solar system which eventually formed out of it. The nebula is beautiful, undoubtedly, but vague and, in a certain sense, useless. The sun formed from it by slow evolution pours forth life, heat and light upon many worlds and their inhabitants. Or we may take another analogy. The human body is composed of countless millions of tiny particles, and some of them are constantly being thrown off from it. Suppose that it were possible for each of these particles to go through some kind of evolution, by means of which it would in time become a human being, we would not say that, because it had been, in a certain sense, human at the beginning of that evolution, it had therefore not gained anything when it reached the end. So, The monadic essence comes forth as a mere outpouring of force, even though it be divine force. The appearance and evolutionary course of the monad may be compared with the appearance of the long day of Brahma, of the Saguna Brahman Sakchidananda, the divine triplicity. That coming forth into cosmic manifestation we have reproduced, in our solar system, by the solar logos, and again by the monad, who is a fragment of the logos. When the human evolution is over, he gathers himself up again, and the superhuman evolution begins. Thus we have the long swing of the opening life, from the nirvanic, back to the nirvanic, the whole of human evolution lying between these two. It is completed with the initiation of the Jivanmukta, the master, where superhuman evolution begins. Whilst the monad in his own world is practically without limitations, at least so far as our solar system is concerned, page 295, yet at every stage of his descent into matter he not only veils himself more and more deeply in illusion, but he actually loses his powers. If, in the beginning of his evolution, we may suppose the monad able to move and to see, in an infinite number of those directions in space which we call dimensions, then at each downward step he cuts off one of these, until, for the consciousness of the physical brain, only three of them are left. Thus, by involution into matter, the monad is cut off from the knowledge of all but a minute part of the worlds which surround him. Furthermore, even what is left to him is but imperfectly seen. For those who can train themselves to appreciate more than three dimensions, there is available an excellent method of arriving at some sort of comprehension of what consciousness on planes higher than the physical is like, and, page 195, what it involves, though at the same time such a method of approach brings home the hopelessness of expecting fully to understand the monad, who is raised by many planes and dimensions above the point from which we are attempting to regard him. All the sacrifices and limitations, caused by descent into matter, may rightly be described as necessitating suffering. But as soon as the ego fully understands the situation, they are undertaken gladly. The ego has not the perfection of the monad, and so he does not fully understand at first, he has to learn. Thus the quite tremendous limitation at each further descent into matter is an unavoidable fact, so that there is that much of suffering inseparable from manifestation. We have to accept that limitation as a means to an end, as part of the divine scheme. There are two senses in which all manifested life is sorrowful, unless man knows how to live it. One of these is to a certain extent inevitable, but the other is an entire mistake, and is easily to be avoided. As we have seen, to the monad, who is the true spirit of man, all manifested life is a sorrow, just because it is a limitation which we in our physical, page 296, brain cannot in the least conceive, because we have no idea of the glorious freedom of the higher life. It is in this sense that it has always been said that the Christ, the second person of the Trinity, offers himself as a sacrifice, when he descends into matter. Undoubtedly it is a sacrifice, because it is an inexpressibly great limitation, for it shuts off from him all the glorious powers which are his, on his own level. The same is true of the monad of man. Undoubtedly he makes a great sacrifice, when he brings himself in connection with lower matter, when he hovers over it through the long ages of its development up to the human level, when he puts down a tiny fragment of himself, a fingertip as it were, and thereby makes an ego, or individual soul. The second kind of sorrow, which it is possible entirely to avoid, is due to desire, using that word in the wide sense to include all desires for lower things, such as craving for power, money, position, and so forth. All such desires necessarily cause disturbance and suffering. Hence, from this point of view, what is most needed for progress is serenity. Hence we have the two first of the four noble truths which the Lord Buddha taught, the existence of sorrow, and the cause of sorrow. Passing now to consider, more specifically, the ego in his relation to the monad, we should realize that the individualizing process, by means of which the ego comes into being, does not take place on the spiritual plane, but that Atma-buddhi, as seen through manas, appears to share in the individuality of manas. Even the ego is not the true, eternal man, For the ego had a beginning, came into existence at the moment of individualization, and whatever has a beginning must also have an end. Therefore even there, page 196, ego, which has lasted since emergence from the animal kingdom, is also impermanent. The monad, and the monad alone, is the only real, permanent man.